أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to Sufi Reflections. On a regular, irregular basis, this podcast is intended, God willing, to introduce you to a wide variety of commentaries, ideas, stories, essays, discussions, interviews, and perspectives concerning not only the Sufi path or tasawwuf, but life in general as well. Through fact, fiction, possibilities, questions, and reflections, this podcast seeks to engage you on a journey of discovery in relation to issues and themes of relevance and significance to everyday life. I am not a sheikh, but I have, by the grace of Allah, been on the Sufi path for over 30 years, and I have benefited greatly by working closely with a Sufi saint of the 20th century for nearly two decades. This podcast is not about trying to guide people on the path, but rather to share some of what I and others have learned in conjunction with pursuing a Sufi way of life. My name is Bill Whitehouse, and God willing, I shall be your host for Sufi Reflection. We speak of God who is hidden, describing the indescribable. You philosophize, I only criticize. Another refutes us both. Yet another, there are always others, will pontificate and vilify, and pin truth down like a dead butterfly. Everyone prognosticates and assassinates with a knowing word, a nod, a distant, seeking look. Each insinuates, even to himself, even that he knows. All these busy mouthing truths cannot speak the hidden truth. Yet each carries in itself an antidote for its being, as blindness contains insight, as a fleeting moment unveils eternity. Be patient. With your counterfeit truths like false coins to the real, is there value to be measured? So like God's word in the book, we learn to discriminate. All is not true, nor all entirely false. As a small dose of poison, a potent medicine makes, so our partial errors, our thirst for impartial good, do slake. This is from Rumi's Mathnawi, and it is from a book called Words of Paradise, Selected Poems of Rumi, New Interpretations by Rafiq Abdullah. One of the features that, God willing, will run fairly regularly on this podcast is a segment entitled Sufi Essays. As the title suggests, these pieces will be commentaries, sometimes brief and sometimes longer, about a variety of topics which, hopefully, may provide you with some thoughts on which to reflect. The title of today's essay is Love. People speak about falling in and out of love. According to Sufi masters, if one falls out of love, there is one thing of which one can be sure. One was never really in love in the first place. Love may come in all kinds of strange, unexpected ways. Yet once love comes, it comes to stay. Love leaves an indelible impression on the heart and soul of an individual. Its stamp is impervious to the erosive tendencies of worldly circumstances. In fact, the difficulties and tribulations of life merely become so many opportunities for love to bring forth its cornucopia of fruits and vegetables, like a fine wine. Love becomes better with time. Love has nothing to do with sexual relationships, although many people confuse and conflate the two. There are a number of fundamental differences between them. Sexuality tends to be dead to everything but itself. Everything, including sexuality, comes alive through love. Love is frequently underrated. Sexuality is often overrated. Sexuality rides on the currents of moods. Love transcends moods. Love involves denial of the ego. Sexuality involves affirmation of the ego. Sexuality very frequently leads to betrayal. Love can never lead to betrayal. In love, something always is being found, in sexuality, something always is being sought. The intensity of sexuality leaves. The intensity of love remains. In order for love to be enjoyed fully, one must be absent. In order for sexuality to be enjoyed fully, one must be present. Sexuality always involves an act of disengagement. This never occurs with love. With love, what is more than enough. With sexuality, more is never enough. One can exhaust the mystery of sexuality, one can never exhaust the mystery of love. Love is willing to sacrifice itself for the sake of others. Sexuality is willing to sacrifice others for its own sake. Sexuality is addictive. Love is liberating. Love is a vocation. Sexuality is an avocation. With sexuality, there is separation during union. With love, there is union during separation. One becomes occupied with love, one becomes preoccupied with sexuality. One can abstain from sexuality, one cannot abstain from love. Love leads towards essence, sexuality leads away from essence. With sexuality, one runs the risk of many diseases. In love, there is a cure for many diseases. One is prepared to die for love, one is prepared to kill for sexuality. A life full of sexuality is common, a life full of love is rare. Love flourishes with constancy, sexuality thrives on variability. According to practitioners of the Sufi path, the love of the spiritual guide for the initiate is a sign of God's love for the seeker. Alternatively, the love of the seeker for the sheikh is a reflection of the individual's love for God. An initiate is obedient to the sheikh because the spiritual guide is the khalifa or vicegerent of God. An initiate desires to learn from the sheikh because the teacher is the one through whom God is providing spiritual guidance, support, and assistance for the seeker. An initiate has love for the sheikh because the spiritual guide is a very special locus of manifestation of God's love for the individual. Sometimes, due to the confusion in the minds and hearts of people concerning love and sexuality, a seeker will interpret the attention, kindness, and love of the spiritual master to be an expression of sexual attraction. This misinterpretation may be complicated by the individual's history of being starved for affection and/or being involved in exploitive or abusive sexual relationships. This can lead to a very difficult trial for both the seeker and the guide. The seeker must learn the difference between love and sexuality without feeling rejected by the teacher. The teacher must try to nourish the seed of love in the seeker without encouraging the weeds of sexuality to grow. In addition, the attention and the affection which the spiritual master gives to one initiate may, through no fault of the sheikh, engender jealousy in other initiates. This jealousy may be fueled by unresolved problems of sexuality concerning the sheikh, or it may be underwritten by other aspects of the ego or some combination of the two. As a result of the foregoing kinds of possibilities, some initiates will begin to project their problems onto the sheikh. In other words, instead of the individual recognizing whatever is going on as originating within himself or herself, the teacher is imagined to be guilty of various kinds of sexual impropriety. Consequently, sometimes even the most innocuous gestures, comments, glances, and so on of the spiritual guide become interpreted through these lenses of confusion. To be sure, there are sexual predators who come dressed in the garb of spirituality. People do get exploited and abused by spiritual charlatans. In fact, sexuality is just one such possibility in the realm of exploitation. There also are people who claim to be spiritual guides, yet who, on the one hand, have not resolved their own confusions concerning love and sexuality, and on the other hand, have not mastered their own egos. Consequently, these sort of people often lead others astray spiritually and as well permit themselves to be led astray in the same fashion. The foregoing comments notwithstanding, a Sufi master is concerned with matters of love, not sexuality. However, because of the times and the kind of society in which we live, many Sufi sheikhs are called upon to minister to people's sexual problems through the healing properties of love. Some people are never able to come to a proper understanding of these issues. For a variety of reasons, such people end up hating the sheikh they often profess to love. This only means they did not love the sheikh in the first place. Anyone in a spiritual context who would be willing to give preference to sexuality over love, or who confuses the two, is admitting the following. The individual is acknowledging that she or he never has drunk the wine of love drawn from the mystical vineyards of divinity. One who has had the latter experience would not risk, God willing, the treasure of divine love for the whole world. Therefore, mere sex would be a sordid substitute for the treasure in question.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful.
Iqra' bismi rabbika alladhi khalaq. Khalaqa al-insana min 'alaq. Iqra' wa rabbuka al-akram alladhi 'allama bil qalam. 'Allama al-insana ma lam ya'lam. Kalla innal insana layatgha aw ra'ahu istaghna inna ila rabbika ruj'a.
Read in the name of thy Lord who created man from a clot. Read, and thy Lord is the most bounteous, who teacheth by the pen, teacheth man that which he knew not. Nay, but verily man is rebellious, that he thinketh himself independent. Lo, unto thy Lord is the return.
أَرَأَيْتَ الَّذِي يَنْهَى عَبْدًا إِذَا صَلَّى أَرَأَيْتَ إِن كَانَ عَلَى الْهُدَى أَوْ أَمَرَ بِالتَّقْوَى أَرَأَيْتَ إِن كَذَّبَ وَتَوَلَّى أَلَمْ يَعْلَمْ بِأَنَّ اللَّهَ يَرَى كَلَّا لَئِنْ لَمْ يَنْتَهِ لَنَسْفَعًا بِالنَّاصِيَةِ نَاصِيَةٍ كَاذِبَةٍ خَاطِئَةٍ فَلْيَدْعُ نَادِيَهُ سَنَدْعُ الزَّبَانِيَةِ كَلَّا لَا تُطِعْهُ وَاسْجُدْ وَاقْتَرِبْ.
Hast thou seen him who dissuadeth a slave when he prayeth? Hast thou seen if he relieth on the guidance of Allah or enjoineth piety? Hast thou seen if he denieth Allah's guidance and is froward? Is he then unaware that Allah seeth? Nay, but if he sees not, we will seize him by the forelock, the lying sinful forelock. Then let him call upon his henchmen, we will call the guards of hell. Nay, obey not thou him, but prostrate thyself and draw near unto Allah.
He who affirms the duality of God in the world falls into the error of associating something with God. And the one who affirms the singularity of God, in excluding from God's reality all that manifests as multiplicity, commits the fault of enclosing God in irrational unity. Beware of comparison when thou envision duality, and beware of abstracting the divinity when thou envisions unity. This is from the writings of Ibn al-Arabi. May Allah be pleased with him.
From high atop the north face of Mount Everest in the majestic Himalayas, You are listening to the Sufi Reflections podcast.
Today's story from Mystical Horizons bears the title, Phoenix Rising.
From the first moment she laid eyes on the man, she was consumed with love for him. She thought about him day and night. He was in her dreams and her fantasies. Through some complex, strange form of association, everywhere she looked, she was reminded of him by what she saw. When he was near, she was in ecstasy, and when he was away, her being was filled with sighs and sobs. She constantly asked the people she met if they had seen him. If they had not, she moved on in search of someone who had, and if the people whom she met had seen the man, she would implore them to give every last detail of their encounters, often asking them to repeat some part of the account which she particularly liked. She only had three problems. First, she already was married to someone else. Secondly, people were beginning to talk, and a huge scandal was brewing because her husband was a very influential and jealous individual. Thirdly, the man of her affections did not appear to be in love with her, and even if he were, his spiritual character was such that he would, God willing, resist any temptation which might be thrown in his path by her. And she did try to seduce him in a variety of ways and on a variety of levels, but without success. These failures did not depress her, in fact, quite the opposite, since the more her plans did not work, the more determined she became, and, as a result, she was spending all her time, effort, talents, and abilities, focusing on winning him over. And she enjoyed this, much like a huntress might enjoy a hunt, in which early setbacks only made the final conquest all the sweeter. A time finally came, however, when her husband was fed up with her antics. More and more, the whole situation had become a huge source of embarrassment for him, because now his wife was not even bothering to hide her obsession from public view anymore, as at least she had done when she first became enamored with and mesmerized by the stranger. His wife and he had become the talk of the town, both in the gossip columns, as well as nearly every party and social occasion being held in the city. He couldn't go anywhere without running into those funny looks which bothered and upset him so much. He knew what lay behind those looks, namely, minds tittering over someone else's misery and difficulty. People heaped ridicule upon him behind his back, and then became excessively quiet whenever he happened by their hushed conversations, only to begin chattering again as soon as he walked a respectable distance away, looking at him recede from them with amusement, smeared on their lips like some uneaten piece of carrion. The situation was affecting his ability to conduct business and politics effectively. Enough was enough, so he threw his wife into the street, and by means which were as cruel as they were legally permissible, he cut her off without a dime, and made sure that no one in the city would give her employment, and consequently she became homeless and a beggar. Many years passed, and the scandal had more or less been forgotten. Occasionally, people in the so-called circles of cultural refinement played Do You Remember?, and reminisced about lives which should have been laid to rest long ago, but were being dug up again as a tonic for some ghoulish hunger, much as a grave robber might go looking for targets of opportunity amidst the shadows of the soul's darkness. And whenever this occurred, the players would recount the whole affair once again. One day, the man who had been the object of the married woman's obsession was on errand in the center of the city. As he crossed the street and was waiting for a car to pass by, he looked toward an alleyway which was next to the store where he was headed, and he thought he saw a familiar face. When he got to the far curb, he took a closer look at the person who was sitting on the pavement, and his earlier impression was confirmed. The woman who had fallen madly in love with him so many years ago was sitting with a bowl in her lap. Her eyes closed, and her lips seemed to be moving. A sign next to her read, "Please give alms for the poor." He took out his wallet and put some currency in the receptacle on her lap. Her eyes remained closed. He stood over her, not knowing whether to move on or stay for a while longer, waiting to see if she would open her eyes. He did not wish to embarrass her, but he had lost track of her after her husband threw her out and often had thought about her with concern, and he would have liked to say hello and see if there was anything he could do for her. She had been a beautiful woman back then. If she had been single, he would have married her in a fraction of a New York second. But since she was not, all he could do was resist her advances, try to avoid her when possible, and feel badly for both her and her husband, since the woman obviously had been struck by a force which transcends all reason. The years, and street time weighs more heavily on humans than can be measured even in dog years, had taken an obvious toll on the woman. She was no longer either young or beautiful. Creases lined her face, and gray eddies ran through her hair. He was about to leave when she stirred, shifted her position slightly, and then opened her eyes. She had the look of someone who had been far away without having gone anywhere. She squinted against the sudden glare of light and looked upward. A smile of recognition came across her lips, and a twinkle came into her gaze. She said, "How are you?" He crouched down to be level with her and put his hand on her shoulder. "I'm fine, and how are you?" She replied, "I am as you see me, and praise be to God, I am happy despite my worldly circumstances." Feeling empathy for her well up in his heart, he realized he still loved this woman, although he could never have confessed to her back then without helping an already impossible situation to deteriorate even further into chaos and madness. He spoke to her of the love which he used to have and still had for her, and why he had been silent about it all these years. She said nothing and just looked at him with affection. There was an aura of satisfaction which had gathered about her like morning mist around a field. He said, "I heard long ago that your husband divorced you. I've often searched for you, but always without success until now. And since you are an eligible woman, if you wish, I would be very happy if you would become my wife and let me take you away from all this." And as he said this, he moved his hand in a general reference to her immediate physical circumstances. She lowered her head and then raised it again and looked into his eyes. She said, "Well, I am single, but I am not eligible." Not sure what she meant by her remark, he said, "I'm sorry, I don't understand." She closed her eyes and began to talk. "Back when I was caught up in my madness concerning you, I did not comprehend what was going on. I didn't realize that the source of my overwhelming love was not you, per se, but rather you were the locus of manifestation through which something else shone, and I confused you with that which was shining through you. I realize now I was like a deer caught in the headlights of divinity, and you were merely the car which brought that light toward me. You were the candle, but God was the flame. She opened her eyes, and although she looked down the street, her vision was somewhere else. As she stared at that which was both near and far, she continued to speak. I no longer have need of an external candle, because the flame burns within me now. The light that shone through you has ignited something within me which, God willing, is self-sustaining, and I am happy with the warmth and joy this inner light gives to me. This has been my companion all these many years. This is what has and continues to sustain me. She returned her gaze to him. You are very loving and sweet to offer your hand in marriage. Indeed, your very loving and kind nature was the wax that formed the candle which, all those many years ago, permitted the divine light to shine through and melt my heart. But I am fine. Now go back to your life with peace, secure in the knowledge that the woman you worried about all these many years has been and is happy and content with her life's destiny. She looked at him for a few more seconds and then closed her eyes, and her lips began to move again in a silent hymn. He stood, looked down at her with a sense of awe and admiration, and then turned and walked away. But the story does not end here, for always that which unfolds is continuously unfolding. Several more years passed. The human candle had just come out of a store and was thinking about whether he should walk home or hail a cab. The weather had been unsettled for most of the day, and rain seemed to be hiding in the air, ready to spill down. He felt a tug on his arm, turned around, and, once more, was looking into the face of the same beggar woman. Without any preliminary chit-chat, she said, "If the offer of marriage still stands, I accept." The man laughed, as much out of the unexpectedness of her words as out of his sense of joy with respect to the potential completion of a chain of events which had been set in motion so long ago. He asked, "Why the change of heart?" She replied, "My heart has not changed, but the light within me has informed me that if I wish to serve that which makes such light possible, then first I should love humankind, and I can think of no better person to start with than you."
The following is a poetical rendering of the last sermon given by a saint of the mystical path, namely Hazrat Khwaja Mo'inuddin Chisti Ajmeri, may God be pleased with him, who passed away nearly 1,000 years ago. With your whole self, daughter and son, try to love all things and hate none. But mere words of peace will not do, nor will talk of God see you through. For in each of us is a gift, a seed of pure grace that can lift, when up from roots of lowly earth to the heights of our timeless worth. Produce your fruits of joy and peace, go share with all and never cease to send perfumes of love that seep gently towards souls not yet complete. Stoke in your hearts truth's blazing fire, let it consume all your desire. So through this will come peace that heals and soothes the hurt which lives conceal. Use the light of your spirit to dispel darkness that touches you. Dissolve storm clouds laden with war. Be kind to the weak at your door. Do not ask for favors from kings nor take what a courtier brings. Do not seek help from any but one, the one through whom all things are done. Yet don't turn the needy away. Exchange laughter for their dismay. Bless the poor and the ones cast out, like the orphan who's filled with doubt. Bless the new widow who is lost, who now must pay what fate has cost. This is your goal, your life's true task, to serve all as you have been asked. Know your duty, learn to be strong. Honor that to which you belong. Guard deeds you do before you die, so from our lips will be no sigh of shame when you finally say farewell to earth on Judgment Day.
The Sufi Lighthouse, Illuminating Spiritual Abuse by Anab Whitehouse, is the only book of its kind. No religious or mystical tradition is immune from the presence of spiritual abuse. For wherever there are people who are seeking to become closer to essential truths, purpose, and meaning, there will be individuals seeking to generate counterfeit currency to offer to those who are unaware of or incautious toward the dangers which lie in wait along the spiritual path. All forms of terrorism, whether these be acts of individuals or of states, presuppose the existence of spiritual abuse. Terrorism cannot occur unless someone, a leader, master, sheikh, or authority figure, uses techniques of undue influence to induce other people to commit atrocities in the name of divinity, justice, and truth. Although a number of chapters within the Sufi Lighthouse focus on the Sufi path, much of this book is relevant to people from all spiritual traditions. This book is 594 pages. If you would like to purchase a copy of this book, please go to spiritual-health.org website. Thank you.
The Sufi path is not just about aspiring to spiritual understanding concerning the potential of one's inherent God-given capacity, but as well, tasawwuf should entail an application of spiritual principles to the problems and events of everyday life. Consequently, from time to time, this podcast will offer reflections on different facets of various social, political, economic, and ecological issues of the day. The purpose of these commentaries is not to induce people to pursue this or that action or policy. Rather, the intention of such commentaries is to provide food for thought, which, God willing, may serve to support responsible, moral, considered action according to one's circumstances and best understanding. For want of a better name, I refer to these occasional commentaries as White House briefs. Although given my nature, some of the commentaries are not always so brief. Today's edition of White House Briefs is entitled Openings. While I share some of the goals which are espoused in What's Right with Islam, a book by Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf, namely its ecumenical spirit as well as its emphasis on such quality as peace, liberty, harmony, justice, democracy, plurality, and moral reciprocity, nevertheless, there seem to be a number of issues that are relevant to the realization of such goals, yet which are not actually rigorously pursued in Imam Rauf's book. Or if they are engaged, this seems to be done in ways that are of questionable persuasiveness, if not tenability. The construction of a logical argument can be a complex, layered, nuanced process. Oftentimes, this is the purpose of writing a book, to devote the time, space, and effort necessary to develop, in as persuasive a manner as possible, at least in principle, the essential features of a perspective, together with the reasons, demonstrations, proofs, and so on, that may assist other individuals to not only understand that world of discourse, as one does, but as well to agree with what is being said. Such arguments build on ideas both little and large. The dynamics of such ideas, which are expressed through the inner structure of a work, form the woof and warp to which the horizon and foci of a discourse are woven. A lot of little things can matter as much as one large issue. Each informs, shapes, and colors the other. Consequently, the validity of each is often caught up with the logical character of the other. The following analysis examines some of the little and large aspects of the book What's Right with Islam. This critical exploration is not exhaustive with respect to all that might have been discussed in conjunction with that book, but I believe the listener will get the gist or drift of where I stand in relation to much of what is contained within Imam Rauf's book. On page XVIII of the preface, one finds the following statement, quote, "The U.S. military victory over Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq means that America is now responsible for shaping a new Iraq." End of quote. The foregoing assertion presumes much and evades even more. One can think of a lot of possibilities that might have been said, perhaps should have been said, in the foregoing observation, rather than what was said. For example, one might have said, "America is now morally responsible for rebuilding the infrastructure of Iraq at its own expense." Or, "America is now morally responsible for paying indemnity to the tens of thousands of innocent families who lost loved ones as a result of the actions of the U.S. government, but who had nothing to do with Saddam Hussein's regime." Or, "America is now legally and morally responsible for leaving Iraq and permitting Iraqis to shape their own destiny." One has trouble understanding how a war that was predicated on lie after lie and falsehood after falsehood, or which was conducted in violation of international law, and which was undertaken without legal authority to do so, gives one any morally sanctioned responsibility to shape another country and people. Invading another country because one wishes to do so, or because it serves one's imperial designs or desire for hegemony, does not constitute legal authority. For if one may wage war simply because of desire, then Nazi Germany had legal authority to invade Czechoslovakia and Poland, or the former Soviet Union had legal authority to invade Hungary, and so on. Moreover, while Saddam Hussein and most of the rest of his pack of jokers may have been apprehended, any talk of victory in the foregoing quote is rather premature. A quote-unquote victory which entails collectively thousands of additional dead, and in which it is not safe to walk the streets or go about life in a normal fashion, is not like any victory I have ever heard of, except, of course, that of a Pyrrhic victory, which some might say is a euphemism for the fact that much more is at stake in Iraq than a PR banner hanging from the upper decks of an aircraft carrier somewhere off the coast of San Diego, far from the realities of what was transpiring in Iraq. A quote-unquote victory, which stands a very good chance of, sooner or later, inducing Iraq to slide into a civil war, is not much of a victory, except to those who want some sort of trophy to mount on the walls of their war room and who are not really all that concerned about what happens to the millions of innocents who have been placed in harm's way by the actions of the U.S. government. Whatever the sins of Saddam Hussein may have been, and they were many, there are three things which need to be kept in mind. First, almost all of his sins were aided, abetted, and subsidized by the United States government across a number of administrations, both Republican and Democrat. Secondly, it is an oxymoron to suppose one can generate democracy by fiat or through brutal oppression. And this is as true for the United States as it was for Saddam Hussein. And finally, the oil resources in Iraq do not belong to the West, or to Saddam Hussein, or to whomever else forms the government there, or to this or that corporation. Those resources belong to the Iraqi people, all of them, and anything else is theft. Imam Rauf goes on to liken what the U.S. military has done and must do in Iraq as falling under the rubric of a saying of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, concerning the distinction between the lesser and the greater jihad. According to Imam Rauf, quote, America has now won the lesser jihad, that of toppling the Saddam regime, end of quote. Something can be a jihad only if it is in compliance with divinely established conditions of morality. There is nothing about the U.S. invasion of Iraq which is moral. Even the pretext of liberating Iraq is an ethical farce because the forces within the executive branch, the Pentagon, and among the leading defense contractors who were architects of this tragedy never had any intention of really permitting the Iraqi people to have self-determination. As has happened so many times before in U.S. history, when the U.S. wants a regime change somewhere, for example, Noriega in Panama, Allende in Chile, Mossad of Iran, the central motivating factor is that whomsoever is to be removed is someone who is refusing to comply with or creating problems for U.S. plans for economic and political hegemony in some given part of the world. The U.S. administration wants a tyrannical government in Iraq, but they want their kind of tyrant, one who would be in harmony with U.S. interests, and the people of Iraq be damned. As long as Saddam served U.S. purposes, for example, waging war against Iran, then Saddam was the man, and he was given wide latitude to amuse himself with the lives of the Iraqi people as he desired. When he stopped serving the purposes of U.S. hegemony and became too big a liability, the U.S. government, or at least certain elements within that government, began to plan for a regime change, not for the purposes of establishing democracy, but for the purpose of arranging for a new government that would be subservient to the interests of the cartel that is now and has been for quite some time running the U.S. government. Dwight Eisenhower knew very well what he was talking about when nearly 50 years ago he warned the people of the United States about the military-industrial complex which was undermining democracy in the United States. It is a travesty of all that the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, taught and lived to try to claim that what the U.S. has done and is doing in Iraq is a lesser jihad, even remotely similar to anything in which the Prophet participated. Indiscriminate killing, injustice, wholesale destruction of a society's infrastructure, and brutal oppression have no place in even a jihad of a lesser kind. Imam Rauf goes on to say, quote, its, that is, the U.S.'s, larger challenge lies ahead, winning the hearts and minds of Iraqis, and through them, the rest of the Muslim world. This waging of peace is now America's greater jihad. End of quote. The greater jihad is about purification of oneself. Before, if ever, one seeks to try to tell others how they ought to live their lives, one should put one's own house in order, Otherwise, at the very least, one is guilty of sheer hypocrisy. If the U.S. government were really interested in waging peace, they never would have begun any of the wars, not under Bush 2 and not under Bush 1. If the U.S. wants to win the hearts and minds of the Iraqis, then it should stop killing them, oppressing them, destroying their means of livelihood, and interfering with their country. The U.S. government is not capable of truly assisting other countries until it cleanses itself of its imperial ambitions. Until the U.S. government stops seeking to control the people of other countries via corrupt, tyrannical governments, or refrains from exploiting those people and cheating them via dealings with corrupt, tyrannical governments, any mention of the quote-unquote greater jihad in conjunction with U.S. policy is nothing but a charade which misdirects attention away from the actual insidious activities of the U.S. government and its corporate buddies. Just as the desire for anything beyond the struggle for truth sullies the idea of the greater jihad in relation to individuals, so too, the desire for anything beyond the struggle to live in accordance with truth taints the intentions of the U.S. government. One can't lust after the resources of another country and claim that one is merely engaging in the greater jihad. One can't dream of exploiting another people and say with any sincerity that one's actions are those of the greater jihad. The greater jihad for the U.S. government has nothing to do with winning the hearts of the Iraqi people or the rest of the Muslim world. The challenge facing the U.S. government is not waging peace in the world, but to purify its own political house and thereby liberate America from the stranglehold which bad government and large corporations have on the American people. If, God willing, the U.S. government is capable of accomplishing this process of self-purification, then in many ways world peace will follow naturally. After all, if the United States government or the corporations it sponsors and subsidizes is not marauding about and interfering in, oppressing, terrorizing, undermining, and destroying the lives of other peoples, then many, although regrettably not all, of the causes of conflict in the world would disappear. Unfortunately, so far, the U.S. government has had neither the honesty nor the insight of an old Walt Kelly comic strip called Pogo, in which one of the characters utters the line, quote, "We have met the enemy, and they is us," end of quote. On page XXI of What's Right with Islam, Imam Rauf says, quote, "Continuing news of suicide bombers in Israel and in Muslim countries such as Pakistan, Indonesia, and Iraq, and more recently in Saudi Arabia and Morocco, have further reinforced American stereotypes about and fear of Muslims. Fear breeds a number of things: hatred of anything associated with, quote unquote, the enemy, from ethnic appearance to clothing and religion, and a circling of the wagons mentality. This country veered uncritically to the right," end of quote. America did not just veer to the right. It was maneuvered in that direction. The generation of an atmosphere of fear has always been one of the main weapons of choice to use to whip the public into a state of compliancy with respect to the wishes of those who are in charge. In the light of substantial historical evidence, such words and phrases as, quote unquote, "remember the Maine," the USS Lusitania, Pearl Harbor, the Gulf of Tonkin, the drug lord Noriega, the innocent college students at risk in Grenada, April Gillespie, the slaughter of the incubator babies in Kuwait, satellite photos showing Saddam about to attack Saudi Arabia, and weapons of mass destruction, all of these incidents have been shown to carry suspect pedigrees concerning the validation of events being what they were portrayed to be by the U.S. government and its media outlets. In each of the foregoing cases, elements within the United States government have been implicated, either directly or indirectly, as helping to arrange for the fictional perpetration of tragedies which enrage the people of the United States and help render the latter target group more supple for purposes of further government manipulation. Similar evidence exists with respect to the 9/11 attacks. If one doubts this, then you might want to read The War on Freedom by Nafiz Mosaddeq Ahmed, in which considerable evidence is put forth about how and why the United States was attacked in 2001 by alleged remnants of Al-Qaeda. One of the scandals of the 9/11 Commission is that it never really explored important aspects of the relevant available evidence. There were vast areas of essential data which were either ignored or glossed over by the Commission, and there were a number of fundamental questions which were never raised by them in any rigorous fashion, if at all. For example, why did it take over an hour and a half for U.S. fighter planes to be scrambled in accordance with standard military operating procedure and FAA regulations? More specifically, both military and FAA authorities knew more than an hour and a half before any of the commercial airlines reached their respective destinations on 9/11 that four planes had been hijacked and were not operating in accordance with their filed flight plans. FAA regulations and standard military operating procedure required that all four incidents were supposed to be eyeballed by pilots on the scene whose duty was to intercept those flights and act accordingly once a determination had been made. It only takes several minutes once an order is given, and why was such an order only given an hour and a half after the fact of the four hijackings, to reach 27,000 feet from an unscrambled position? Why wasn't this done? One also would like to know why the scrambled military planes came from Massachusetts rather than bases which were right next to Washington and New York City. The added distance subtracted valuable, perhaps critical, reaction response time. Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 has a lot of fun with the 7 minutes of inaction when President Bush sat in a Florida classroom listening to children read rather than politely excusing himself from responding to the information he had been given about ongoing events in the air. The fact of the matter is, however, news reports indicate President Bush knew about the hijackings before he ever went into the grade school classroom, and so the question which Michael Moore appears to have omitted is why didn't the president do anything about the situation before he went into the classroom? Only the president can give the order for commercial airplanes to be shot down. Without a doubt, having to make a decision about whether to destroy innocent lives aboard those commercial flights rather than risk the potential of even greater loss of innocent lives on the ground would be a terrible burden for any human being. But if someone can give the order to attack Afghanistan with the understanding that innocent lives will be lost, and if someone can give the order to attack Iraq with the clear understanding that innocent lives will be lost, then perhaps someone should have been ready to make a decision that would have made subsequent decisions to attack Afghanistan and Iraq less easy than they appeared to be. There may be entirely reasonable answers for all of these questions. However, one won't know this for a fact until all of this is given a rigorous public airing and critical scrutiny, something the media has not done to date, nor, as far as I can see, has the 9/11 Commission properly addressed, unless they did so behind closed doors and feel the U.S. public has no right to know about issues which directly affect our lives, our sense of security, or our confidence in the integrity of government. The foregoing is not an effort to foment conspiracy theories. Rather, it is intended to induce people to question the version of events that is put forth by authority. Time and time again, people in authority have proven themselves unworthy of the trust of the people. In fact, due to the sheer quantity of prevarications on the part of all too many government officials for all too many years, the general operating procedure of the public should be that anything the government says should be handled through hazmat protective gear until one can establish that the information is not toxic or hazardous to one's health. Just because some government employee or elected official offers an quote-unquote official version of events, this doesn't mean the official version is a true reflection of what actually happened. It may only mean that this sort of official version is what such government figures want the public to believe in order to advance ulterior, illicit machinations of their own. None of the foregoing is to suggest that the terrible things that were transpiring in Muslim countries were not taking place, or that there were no reasons for a prudent person to be fearful about how events were spinning out of control almost everywhere. However, such events were only part of what was going on, and there is much need for something akin to when Paul Harvey would say, quote, "And now for the rest of the story," end of quote. For much has been kept from the eyes, minds, and hearts of the American people by its own government officials, not just with respect to 9/11, but with respect to several hundred years of history. I agree with Imam Rauf when he says, in relation to the aforementioned reactionary move to the right of America, that it was largely uncritical, at least among large sections of the public, much of the media, and most of the politicians. However, there were many forces in play that were designed to shield events from the probing, curious eye of critical reflection, and therefore, it was not just happenstance that events were ushered towards the right in an uncritical fashion. There was a conscious intentionality guiding this move rightward into a reactionary state of fear. In conjunction with the foregoing, Imam Rauf raises the question, quote, "Was Samuel Huntington right? Were we witnessing a, quote, clash of civilizations, end of quote, between the West and the rest, in this case, between Western civilization and Islam," end of quote. The short answer is no. What we were witnessing, which requires a much longer answer, were a series of staged events or predictable reactions to staged events that were designed to frame the understanding of the public in certain ways. The purpose of these attempts to frame people's perception of reality was to enable various parties to have a pretext or justification and or plausible deniability with respect to seeking to organize the world according to the agenda of hegemony, and this is as true for the fundamentalist religious zealots as it is for the fundamentalist capitalistic and military zealots, both of whom seduce their irrespective spheres of influence like a cat in heat. According to Imam Rauf, the events of 9/11 changed him and his life. Quote, "I went from refusing to get dragged into politics because I saw it as a no-win situation to being forced to explain myself and defend my faith," end of quote. "Unlike the author of What's Right with Islam, I do not feel the need to explain myself or defend my faith. With respect to the latter matter, my faith is precisely that, my faith, and as such, it is not something which I have to defend to others." Of course, Imam Rauf may mean he felt the need to defend Islam. But here again, Islam does not need any defense. It is what it is, and God defends it very well, which is why, among other things, there has been a long tradition of prophets, some 125,000 individuals long, who have been sent to human beings in order to help people understand the nature of spirituality and why, as well, there have been a number of books of revelation which were issued down through the ages. Furthermore, I do not feel the need to explain myself to anyone. I didn't fly those planes on September 11th, 2001. I am not a member of Al-Qaeda, nor do I support or endorse their activities, nor have I done anything to either subvert the Constitution of the United States, nor to exploit the peoples of other lands or interfere with their lives. Several decades before 9/11 ever occurred, I chose not to participate in U.S. aggression against other peoples. I do not now countenance acts of aggression against the United States. The exercise of violence solves very few, if any, problems. In general, and with the possible exception of defending one's home or country against armed invasion, I tend to agree with the sentiments of Isaac Asimov as expressed in his Foundation series when one of his characters says, quote, "Violence is the last refuge of incompetence," end of quote. In addition, for more than 30 years, I have been actively engaged in striving for truth in matters of spirituality, justice, equality, freedom, peace, and human rights, with governments, universities, the media, Muslims, and non-Muslims. Hostility and anger towards Muslims did not suddenly erupt on 9/11. I can remember in 1967 when I was working in the Student Center cafeteria at MIT. The television was carrying news coverage of the 1967 war between Israel and some of its Arab neighbors. With each advance and victory of the Israeli army, there was much cheering and jubilation that took place in the room where the television was. And as well, there was much jeering and contempt towards the Arabs and Muslims. I was not a Muslim at the time, and I was not partial to either side. However, I do remember that hostility, contempt, and anger, which were present and directed towards Arabs and Muslims. During half of the 1970s and for much of the 1980s, I experienced firsthand, as a recent convert to Islam, the deep-rooted suspicion, enmity, and ignorance that existed in many parts of the West with respect to Muslims and Islam. More specifically, as a member of a Muslim organization, which published a report that was critical of the offensive and inaccurate material concerning Islam and the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, which appeared in a number of school textbooks being used in the public school systems in the province of Ontario, I went round and round the barn with all manner of alleged intellectuals, media types, and government officials about the many facets of prejudice. During this period of time, I received a remarkable education concerning the underbelly of Western quote-unquote civilization. I discovered there were many so-called experts of Islamic studies who preferred error to accuracy and who were quite indignant that anyone should object to the way in which their lack of understanding or personal animosities or special interests would be used to validate ignorance. I encountered representatives of the media who believed it was their God-given duty to perpetuate ignorance and bias concerning Muslims and Islam. I negotiated with government officials who did what many government officials do best: evade, procrastinate, stonewall, lie, and manipulate. I remember an instance in which a group of people from a local mosque were lodging an official complaint with a business in the vicinity. The group had asked me to be its spokesperson. When we were ushered into the office of the manager of the business with which we were concerned, the manager looked at me, and then he looked at the others who were from Pakistan, Africa, India, and the like. And then he looked back at me. He whispered to me, because I was the closest to him, quote, "I know what they're doing here, but what are you doing here?" End of quote. I pointed over to the group of people with whom I arrived and whispered back, "I'm one of them." Alternatively, I also recall a number of instances when Muslims actively voiced their hostility towards me and resented my presence because my skin color and spiritual pedigree were not to their liking. So prejudice and bias are not the exclusive preserves of non-Muslims. In the early 1980s, Sheikh Ahmed Zaki Yamani, the Minister of Oil for Saudi Arabia, came to Canada. My Sufi Sheikh sought a meeting with Sheikh Yamani in an attempt to get support from him with respect to some of the textbook bias work we were doing and related matters. My Sheikh didn't think we had much of a chance of meeting with the extremely busy minister, but my Sheikh thought, well, nothing ventured, nothing gained. To his surprise, we received a call back from the person managing appointments for the oil sheikh and said we had been granted a 5-minute audience with the oil minister on such and such a day. When we went for our appointment, the RCMP and Canadian officials who were present but outside the room where Sheikh Yamani was receiving people were quite curious about just who we were and why we were seeing the Saudi oil minister. What was scheduled for 5 minutes turned into a meeting of an hour or more. Whatever curiosity the Canadian authorities had prior to our meeting with the Sheikh was quadrupled or more by the time our meeting was through. It turned out that the oil minister was and is a great lover of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. When he discovered that we also were lovers of the Prophet, all formalities, time constraints, and official distance which might have been between us disappeared. While he served each of us tea in a very humble and attentive way, he talked about his family, some of the miraculous things which had happened to him, and much more. He invited members of the group to visit him in Saudi Arabia as his guests, all expenses paid, He gave each of us a personal gift of some kind. As Saudi oil minister and one of the leading strategists of OPEC's 1973 price hike, he easily could have destroyed the West if he wanted to do so. He was not interested in doing that. Rather, he simply wanted international economic arrangements that would establish as much distributive justice as possible for all parties concerned, Muslim and non-Muslim. When the price hike came, people in the West were outraged with the OPEC countries. What right did OPEC have to do this? These same people who were complaining would think nothing about mouthing the platitude of the law of supply and demand if they stood to benefit from the scarcity of a non-renewable resource. Moreover, these same people would lose absolutely no sleep over the hardships placed on nations through the economic restructuring pressures imposed by the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund as conditions for getting loans, and yet these same people would howl in outrage when the quality of their lives is adversely affected due to the pressures of economic restructuring caused by the action of others, such as OPEC. The events which ensued from 9/11 in relation to hostility towards and hatred of Muslims and Islam was more of the same of what had been going on for a long, long time. The only difference was that now Americans had been killed or were suffering directly or indirectly as a result of the attacks, and perhaps for the very first time, Americans as a people had some visceral insight into how Muslims in other parts of the world have been feeling for several hundred years as imperial powers from the West killed, pillaged, plundered, and raped their countries and peoples. That people died in the World Trade Towers, the Pentagon, and in a field in Pennsylvania gives expression to a great injustice against those innocent individuals. But the people of America should get a grip on themselves and garner a little historical perspective, for such things have been happening with great regularity all over the world, and our government is not innocent in such matters. The fact that much of the American public is ignorant about these kinds of issues, and intentionally kept that way for the most part, does not mean that similar, if not worse, tragedies have not been occurring elsewhere in the world. If someone screams in pain and no one hears it or pays attention to it, the fact of the matter is that the person who screams still feels pain. If anyone needs to explain themselves, it is the United States government and all of those Muslim governments who have aided and abetted U.S. and Western imperial aims. If anyone needs to explain themselves, it is the so-called democratic countries that have bequeathed something other than democracy to its citizens. If there is anyone who needs to explain themselves, it is all the so-called Muslim leaders who have betrayed Islam and their compatriots by establishing something other than peaceful conditions in which a person's pursuit of Islam can prosper without compulsion and oppression. If there is something which is demanded of the present situation, it is for a resolute intention among all human beings to seek as much as possible the truth of things and not be satisfied with the shoddy, self-serving offerings of this or that government.
This week's edition of the Sufi Reflections podcast has been brought to you by the Interrogative Imperative Institute, where the process of asking questions becomes an artful journey to solutions for life.
Well, that's all for this edition of the Sufi Reflections podcast. I hope you have enjoyed the program and found the various segments thought-provoking and interesting. As indicated in the introduction to this podcast, programs will be produced on a regularly irregular basis. Essentially, this means that the next edition may appear next week, or then again, there may not be another podcast for several weeks. Sufi Reflections gets done, God willing, as time permits. And unfortunately, time doesn't always permit me the degrees of freedom necessary to put programs together, which is a lot more time-consuming than the running length of any given podcast. Nonetheless, I will strive mightily to provide a new program for your listening enjoyment in the near future. Until then, Assalamu alaikum.